Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice in collaboration with the Pastoral Formation Institute, entitled "The Contribution Which Committed Laypersons Are Called to Give in Public Life." This talk is delivered by Father Fernando Franco.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. We pray for all those millions of lay people in the Church, all the baptized, that we, the people of God, will know what the Lord wants from us and will have the courage to be faithful to our mission. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. I wish to welcome you all, the Pro-Vicar General, Father Anton Guder, all members of the Curia that are present, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice and the Pastoral Formation Institute, I welcome you to this public lecture on the theme, "The Contribution Which Committed Laypersons Are Called to Give in Public Life." Recently, I was on the radio, on a church radio, and a person phoned in. We were discussing politics with not partisan politics, but politics nonetheless. And this person said, "I am very worried that you are speaking about politics on the radio, on the church radio. It is the only radio," she said, "which I feel comfortable with and trust my husband to listen to, since it does not discuss politics. Is politics dirty? Is it right for Christians to be involved in public life?" The Lord says also, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." Should the church get involved in politics? Aren't the church and the state autonomous? Some hot political issues in Malta today include:
Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice in collaboration with the Pastoral Formation Institute, entitled "The Contribution Which Committed Laypersons Are Called to Give in Public Life." This talk is delivered by Father Fernando Franco.
Why are 15% of children living in poverty today? Why are there still many children failing school? The issue of irregular immigration, sharing responsibility among EU states vis-à-vis immigrants coming from Africa, combating xenophobia and racist attitudes. Another issue: why is it that Malta is being built up, destroying our natural environment, while around 19% of houses are empty? Why is it that so many gaming shops are opening up all over the island? And we can continue with many other hot issues. I want to welcome His Grace Monsignor Mario Grech, who has come all the way from Gozo. Thank you for being here. Are lay people called to stick their necks out on hot political issues in Malta today? Is it their duty to be involved in political life? And does this duty touch all lay persons in some way? I am honored to introduce to you our distinguished guest speaker, Father Fernando Franco. Father Fernando Franco was born in San Sebastian, Spain, joined the Jesuits of the Loyola province, and in 1965 went to India, where he obtained a PhD in economics from the University of Bombay. He taught macroeconomics, econometrics, and development economics at St. Xavier's College. Joined the Jesuit-inspired NGO Behavioral Science Center, Ahmed Dabad, I don't know if I pronounce it properly, and was director for 10 years of the fellowship program in development management, offered by the same NGO. Together with other colleagues of the same center, he worked extensively in devising and conducting training programs for Dalit and tribal community organizers. He has written extensively on socio-economic and cultural problems of these two communities. At present, he is the Secretary for Social Justice at the Jesuit Curia at Rome. That means he is in charge of the Jesuit Social Apostolate worldwide. It is a great honor that I have to introduce him to you, I'm very happy that he immediately accepted our invitation, and I now invite him to address us on this very important issue which challenges the whole church and in particular the laity, the contribution which committed laypersons are called to give in public life. Thank you.
My dear friends, in the Lord, I think it's a very Jesuit way of greeting you here today. I must confess right from the beginning that I am a very simple man, and whatever he has said in the introduction looks to me a little big. But let me say that I have, right from the beginning, to confess a limitation. I suffer from a problem of identity. I was born in the Basque country, but was not allowed to speak the Basque language in the school. I am supposed to be Spanish by citizenship. I lived 37 years in India, and I wanted to become an Indian, but the color of my skin betrays me at any railway station or bus station. And suddenly one day when I was in New Delhi, they asked me to come to Rome. I received an email. We are in the era of emails. In the morning, it was about 6 years ago, would you consider the possibility of coming to Rome and doing this job? And I almost got a heart attack. So I was parachuted into close to the Vatican City, where I live now in the General Curia. So you will understand that I suffer from certain, limitations or imbalances. I divided my reflection in an introduction where I will try to say a few things, and in three main points. The first point that I will try to make is that we live in a context, in a world that has dramatically changed. And unless we understand a little what are the main characteristics of this world, we may not be able to understand what our commitment as laypersons could be. The second point I want to make is to speak about a new understanding of the relationship between religion and public life today, not so much within the church, but outside the church. And finally, the third point, tentatively, humbly, a few suggestions for what I call a methodology to shape public policy. And let me begin with the introductions. I am not an expert in public policy, and therefore I must confess a certain ignorance. I am aware and grateful for the invitation. I am a visitor. And therefore, I am not coming here to tell you, far from me, what is to be done, but I come here as a companion, as a traveler, to help you reflect on a number of issues confronting us today as Catholic, Christians, and human beings. Two clarifications. What is a committed lay person? I must confess that I was slightly touched by committed lay persons. We will not say committed Catholic priests. We assume the priests to be committed, but apparently a lay person, we need to put the adjective committed. Well, how would I define and understand this? Two examples, very quick. 3 weeks ago, I was in Quebec, French Canada, visiting a work of the Jesuits run by a lay person called Henry, a convinced Catholic, a practicing Catholic. He was running a center to receive those kinds of young people dressed in black, chains everywhere, tattoos here, some kind of hair. And I asked him, because it is the first time I entered, I was frightened. And then when you came to know the story, I was doubly frightened, because many of those young people who come to that house, open house, well, they come with something inside. And I told him, Henry, what the hell? Why are you doing this? And he told me, these young people, you see, they think that they are still in adolescence. They think that life is permanent adolescence, even when they are 26. So I try to be an adult that loves them. I love them, but I am an adult. I am not an adolescent. That was a committed layperson, Henry. Let me give you another example so that I may not be misunderstood. I would like to consider a committed lay person. Mr. Dinesh, the director of ActionAid in India, at a time, it was not too many years ago, 2002, I experienced terrible communal, they are called riots, between Hindu and Muslim communities in Ahmedabad. He is a Hindu, and he works in this NGO. And he is a great leader in civil society. After the riots, 2,000 Muslims were butchered with the connivance of the police and the state government. We as Christians, as a persecuted minority at the moment in India, it was very difficult for us, but we went all we could to help the Muslim community. And this person, 2 days after the riots, was the only Hindu in the city of Ahmedabad, 2 million people, who publicly went to the radio station and had an appeal. And he said, I appeal to you, my brother, Hindu brothers, to be first and foremost human beings. Then you can be Hindus. That Mr. Dinesh, I consider him a committed layperson. Two examples. Let me clarify the second term, public life. What do I mean by public life? By engaging myself in public life. By public life, I mean the actions that I take individually and sometimes collectively to affect directly the shaping of public policy. I consider that a person engaged in political life is definitely engaged in public life. But I do consider a very important section of civil society and NGOs that are sometimes indirectly, sometimes directly trying to shape public policy. Public policy, two examples. For example, those engaged in trying to balance public policy between keeping border security and the dignity of asylum seekers. Another example, those engaged in ensuring equal and quality education for all. People engaged in shaping a nation's policy regarding these two issues, for example, I would consider them as those engaged in public life. Let me come to the first point of my reflection. We live in a new world, in a world that has changed profoundly. I may not deal with this topic in detail, maybe I leave later on for some questions, but I think it is important to understand, because I do feel that many of the problems or the issues that I see that agitate you here in this country are part of a broader canvas of what is happening today. Let me give you a few examples and characteristics. The first example, whether the country is small or big, north, south, democratic or non-democratic, we all are interconnected today. This is extremely important because we cannot say that we can, you know, shape our future independently of what is happening all over the world. An example. China, a communist country. The crisis begins, economic crisis, financial crisis begins in the US, in the subprime financial markets. During the last two months, 20 million Chinese workers around that coast where the industrialization is centered have left the cities and gone back to the villages because there is no more work. And now I say we all are interconnected. And now China cannot say that being a communist country, that it is independent of what happens anywhere. What happens in Africa is going to affect the whole of Europe. And one of my presuppositions is that something very serious is happening in Africa. Maybe I'll come later to that. And that is affecting us, one way or the other. Second, we live in a multicultural and plurireligious world. You go to Ireland now, and at the moment of the crisis, people begin to say, what is going to happen to the Polish people who have migrated to Ireland and have been working here? In the last 5 years, they calculate that almost 500,000 Poles are working in Ireland. You travel in the metro, whether it is London or Madrid, metro, and if it is a Saturday, you will find very few of those that we call originals. I have done that experience, and they are any part of the world. Perhaps without the shocks of migration, you walk in Brazil today with the whole Afro-descendant movement beginning and taking shape and tremendous force, and you realize that something has changed in this world. And you can close your eyes and say, but you see, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, well, we are today, and that's different. Third, we are living in a world in which inequalities have increased in spite of the tremendous economic growth. Inequalities have increased within countries. Inequalities in the United States have been greatest, the largest, even before the crisis began. Not to speak about other countries. You visit Nigeria, and then you pass from the most luxury type of richness in the center of Lagos to the most miserable situation. So we've had a process of growth that has marked our societies with that kind of mark of inequality. And this has become worse because of the financial and economic crisis. Fourth characteristic, and I think we are getting into waters that are perhaps more contested. We live in a world obsessed with identity. What a curious thing. Whether it is cultural or whether it is religious. And you will find young people today in the outskirts of Guatemala or in San Francisco or in anywhere in a European place that I mentioned tattoos. And they belong to a group, to a Mara, as they say in Latin America, and that they require to give them identity. Because in the world in which they live, there is nothing. And that identity leads to a lot of violence. But I am coming now to something closer to us that is defining our world and our obsession with identity. Religious fundamentalism. I come, as I told you, from a country that has lived and believed in tolerance. I come from a country that has worshipped Mahatma Gandhi, the man of peace. This country is today polarized. Hindu fundamentalism is trying to re-understand history and is trying to use religion for political purposes. And is persecuting Muslims, Christians, and all religious minorities. I have visited 6 months ago the state of Orissa, and I have seen poor Christians being killed mercilessly because they were Christians. Buddhist religion, Buddhism, the Buddha that proclaimed compassion and peace. These last days you are reading the tragedy of Sri Lanka, where Tamils are being butchered, civilians. I regret the position of the Tamil rebels, LTTE, but I think the whole movement of Buddhism and the political history of the last 15 years in Sri Lanka has been terrible. Again, religion used for political purposes. I would not like, and let me say this with humility and respect, I would not like to pass without saying a word about some forms of Christian fundamentalism, terrible, that have invoked the law of God to invade a country. Again, using so-called Bible statements, for what purpose? A form of fundamentalism is racism. Everywhere on the increase. You will forgive me the example. I come from just now from Rome, and 3 days ago in the paper is the story of this boy, young boy, who is playing calcio, football, and he's playing now, I think, for the Juventus. I'm not very clear about that, but I think it's that. He comes from Mali. His parents came from Africa. He was born in Italy. He's an Italian. He's got a passport. And the other day, a section of the crowd started shouting at him, "You are not Italian, you are not Italian, you are a black." Later on, of course, the football, the calcio, the federation came, and they have closed, I think, the stadium of the Juventus for one season. But that makes me think, what this is the world in which we are living. Reasons why is this coming? This is what the texture of human life is made of today. Next characteristic. We live in a fragmented world. You may call it postmodern, not only conceptually, but socially. I'll just give you a few examples. The utopias have disappeared. Nobody believes in utopias. We believe that the truth is partial. Belief in institutions? No, we don't. Long-term commitments? No, please. Short-term, for today, we'll see tomorrow. We don't know. And this is affecting many of us. Families, broken, fragmented. This is the world in which we live. And I end with the last characteristic I want to talk to you. To me, one of the most important ones, and something which is at the back of a number of things that we have said. We live in a world in which fear and anxiety, both of them are being fabricated, transmitted, generated for political considerations. I don't see any other reason. Examples I like to give from outside, and you can make the connections and the applications. For the last 3 years, there is a constant refrain in India. Christians are a threat. They are coming here with a religion that has always been Western. They are going to come to this country and they are going to destroy what? The culture of this country, which is Hindu. The Muslims, my God, the Muslims. The Muslims have the history and go back to the Muslim history. They have destroyed this country in the past and they... Therefore, do away with them in any way you can. Fear. Analyze the facts, some of the facts. The percentage of Christians, not only Catholics, in India has been 2.3% after independence, 1948. Today, 2000, the census was made at 2000, it is 1.96. The percentage has decreased. 1.9% in a population of 1,000 million people, and the Christians constitute a threat to the fabric of a country. Now, if you sit down quietly and you look at the figures and the facts, you say, but how can this lie be sold? But it is. It is sold. And it is being transported. The culture of this country has been Hindu the whole life. The culture of a country like India is a melting pot of so many cultures. Not even Hindu culture, the Aryan invasion, was the original one. There were original people living there who were pushed out so that the invaders could come. What is original? What is not original? But people, educated people, you talk to them and you say, you people come here to convert, you come here to make numbers, and you come here to destroy Hinduism. Six characteristics of the world in which we live. The last one, to me, is crucial. I don't quote the example of the US recently about security. It is on the same line. But systematically, there is a policy of or an interest in distributing fear. Let me come to the second point. I'll try to be brief. There has been a change in the way one understands today the relationship between religion and public life. It's a very interesting change. I am not going to talk about Catholic social teaching, which has always, always accepted that there is a difference, and yet the Church, the values of a Christian person must influence public policy, the shaping of public policy. I am going to talk very briefly about what I would call the extreme secularist position. How would I define the extreme secularist position? Very simple. It's the belief that religion and faith have to be driven out from the public realm and have to be secluded within the private and individual space. Religion is a private affair. Let bishops, lay people, speak about religion within their own communities. This obviously has been a strong reaction. I will not enter into history. The church invaded the public sphere. The church invaded the state. And there are today philosophies and countries that want again a religious ideology to invade the area of the state. I think the church has been quite clear and has rejected this position. And maybe the church has taken 300 years to understand that. That is the background. What's happening today? And I'm going to talk to you of three examples very briefly. Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of England, has launched a new foundation. He converted to Catholicism, and he has launched a new foundation, Faith and Globalization. And he's proposing openly that faith and religion have a role to play today in shaping public policy. And he makes five propositions which I think may be interesting for us. He says, we must not believe that to have faith makes us abnormal or weird people. Second, faith does not mean a person engaged in public life with faith doesn't mean that your religion makes you act without freedom and without reason, as if you were answering because you have faith to somebody behind you in a sort of cultic way is pressing certain buttons for you to act. That's not to have faith. Third, to have faith does not want that you want to impose your faith on others. Fourth, you have faith and you are in public life, it doesn't mean that you pretend to be better than others. And finally, the fact that you have faith doesn't mean that you want to co-opt God to legitimize your own political agenda. If you keep these five things, I think faith, he says, is absolutely essential in today's world. Second example, you may say, well, he converted to Catholicism, but the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, is confronted with the problem of climate change in the world, and you know how serious and how difficult this problem is. About 3 months ago, I received an invitation for the Jesuits to consider the possibility, like many other religious leaders, and the Vatican also, to engage in a dialogue with the UN so that before the famous meeting in Copenhagen is going to decide in November, December, what is going to be the final policy, the UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon wants that religions take a stand on climate change, take a position and take a commitment, so that when the leaders of all nations gather together at Copenhagen, religious leaders can say, you are not dealing with a problem that concerns only you, it concerns all of us. And from our religious values, we strongly commit ourselves to preserve the relationship of the earth. It is not for us to tell you what is going to be the percentage of carbon dioxide that we can trade with each other. Those are things that you may have to decide. But we want to tell you that our religious leaders, we need to change our relationship to the earth. UN Secretary General wants faith-based organizations to engage in this process. Why? Very simply. By tampering and tweaking with fiscal procedures and laws, you are not going to change the relationship of the human, of all of us today, to the earth. Third and final point. There is a change. I mentioned just now in the second point that in a way is much more positive or much more open to the positive role that faith and religion today can have in public life. Provided that certain conditions, and I think these are ordinarily acceptable conditions. I want to come now to a more somewhat practical way. And the last point would be, what is the methodology that we can adopt to shape public policy? These ideas that I'm sharing with you are not my own original ideas. These are ideas of a number of people now engaged in defining social ethics at a more global level. So I propose to you that a successful methodology to achieve success at the level of change in public policy needs to combine three ways of acting, each one important: the prophetic, the dialogical, and the pragmatic. Let me take briefly each one of them. The prophetic way. As religious people, and as, yes, Catholics, we need to say and speak the truth. And the simple truth for us is that love your enemies, love suffering people, and love the dignity of every human being, no matter what happens. I want to give you an example. I've come across this example and I find it very, very, very terrifying. It was the year 1944. And an obscure moral theologian in the United States, he happened to be a Jesuit, Father Ford, John C. Ford, wrote an article called The Morality of Obliteration Bombing, translated into a language that we understand, The Morality of Atomic Bombing. He wrote a strong article saying that obliteration bombing is an immoral act on the rights of the innocent. It includes a direct intent to do them injury, and therefore it is not morally acceptable. 1944. 1945, the US government dropped two atomic bombs, one in Hiroshima and the second one in Nagasaki. If you read the biography of Truman, you will see how he justifies this act. But the point I want to make is that that man thought he had the duty to say publicly what, according to him, was a call of conscience. Atomic bombing, obliteration bombing, is immoral. And you will say, well, these prophetic voices, for what? 30 years later, perhaps too many years later, the Second Vatican Council said, any act of war, and I quote, aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities, of extensive areas, along with their population, is a crime against God and man himself. I hope that this element does not die among ourselves. Because if it dies, then what is the use of saying that we believe in certain principles? But a successful methodology needs to take in the prophetic, and it needs to take in the second element, the dialogical. Together, in different ways, but it has to be dialogical. It means that you need to sit down and bring to a table everybody who has a stake in what is happening. Not only those who think like you, but those who don't think like you. You need to bring them all. You have to go beyond your own ideology, maybe your own prophetic word, but you have to say your prophetic word, but you have to listen to others. You say, oh my God, you are now coming down. Well, I am coming down, I don't know, or coming up. I'll give you two examples. The International Labour Office, ILO, 8 years ago, wrote a report on globalization and labor, a report that was written by the cooperation of 25 people. You had right, left, you had trade unions, and you had business, and you had west, east, north, south. It is one of the most beautiful reports on globalizations, opportunities, and tremendous dangers. The IPCC is the famous report written on climate change. It has been written by a group of people belonging to various, with various interests. It is possible, and I would add, dialogue not only about my issue, not only about ecology, because I am, you know, green from top to bottom. But I need to talk. I need to open the dialogue about land. And I need to talk about education. And about health. And about migration. And the third, pragmatic. And therefore, I feel that engaging in public policy is not only a matter of one messiah, but it is a matter of a group. We cannot tackle this individually and alone. What do I mean by pragmatic? We must sit down and say, is it feasible now? Is it feasible in the way we write it and we say it? Is it we want everything now, 100% of my idea to come through, or you want to have a stepwise approach? Are you talking of the short term, but are you forgetting the long term? Are you assessing the strengths that you have in this dialogue? And are you assessing the difficulties ahead of you? Are you using the media in a convincing way to get across your idea? Or do you think that by opening your mouth in the most passionate way in the world in which we live, we are going to get the common good for all? The prophetic voice, the dialogical voice, and the pragmatic voice. I always feel that a group that can handle this together is a very powerful group. I do feel that lay people have been called to play this role very forcefully in a way in which, in a world in which it is very complex. But we can act, and we can act together. And I hope that God gives us the grace to to realize that we are interconnected and that we have to act together with a plan, allowing the prophetic, allowing the dialogue, and allowing the pragmatic. Thank you very much, and God bless all of you.
Thank you very much, Father Fernando Franco, you have given us the context to see how we can be faithful to our mission here in Malta. Some time ago when I was studying at university, we were told that children, if you give them a glass which is half full of water, this is not half full, but almost, there's some water in it. If you tell them to imagine the glass turned, they will draw the water still parallel to the bottom. Why? Because they don't see the whole context. And what you have said helps us to see things in a much wider context. Now I would invite you all, whoever wishes, to ask questions or to raise any points which you feel are relevant to this discussion. Thank you.
Father, you have a global experience in your person, which is a gift from God. Now, the church we're in hopes that Europe, the garden of the faith, through a perseverance of Christians, particularly Christian laity, particularly by the deepening of the theology of the Trinity, will be able to help the world develop a new civilization of love. So the three points you've mentioned, to me, seem to beg the explicit expression of deeper Christian theology about personality, a theology able to support the cultural evolution of love in the families, and also in public life, the commitment and the dialogue to the common good. So the questions I want to ask you are, do you think that the wage contract in civilization, the contract of work in civilization, and the question of the distribution of property, do you think that these points are coming together around the world through the credit crisis?
I am not very sure that I may have understood correctly the entire thing, but I may humbly offer some suggestion. You have used the word deepening Christianity and the word civilization of love, and I think they are correct. But I think we have to look at them, and I think we have to both to be prophets from what Benedict, our Pope, speaks about caritas, love, to God, in our relationship to God, and in our relationship to our neighbor. So it is a deepening of love, definitely. Now, in a world in which we live, with so many differences, I would like that we are able to talk across with people with different faiths or with no faith at all. And that we can talk about a new world in which this love is respected. And each one will have perhaps a different perspective, but I do believe that deep down we can reach some concrete points. At other points we may not, of action in public life. I consider that it is in this direction a number of things that are happening today in the world. I do feel that changes that have taken place in the world, in the way women are considered, no matter the country, no matter the religion, in some still there is a lot to do. I consider this as a deepening of the civilization of love. I consider a deepening of civilization of love the fact that after apartheid, South Africa today has had free elections in which everybody has been able to say what he wants or she wants independently of the color of his skin. I consider it a movement in deepening the civilization of love the fact that the majority of indigenous people in Bolivia today can exercise their vote and can decide, like other people and citizens, what they want for their country. Let me end up by saying something, because you mentioned contract distribution of property and the credit crisis. I'm not very sure exactly what you mean, but what I consider is that this crisis in which we are, and it's not only my own way of thinking, is a very deep crisis. It began as a financial crisis, but it is calling into question a number of values through which a number of public policy has been decided. Thank God, for example, it's calling into question the existence of fiscal paradises, where black money from narco-traffic and drug traffic has been accumulated, not to say many other things. So, I would say that this crisis may offer us a situation in which we can consider whether the way we are living is a way in which we can live together, all together as human beings, for the common good. I am an optimist. And I am an optimist, and I'll give you now, it's an experiential, but it's a religious reason. My life in different parts of the world, and especially these last 6 years, I have traveled all over the world. I personally feel that God is working in this world. I am not very sure how good I am at making some change. I think we have to try, and I have talked here today because I expect that lay people, you and I, we have to try. But believe me, God has never abandoned this world, and God will never abandon this world. And if I am here tonight, it's not because I want to tell you this is the solution. It's because I want to tell you that God is here working today. And if we open our eyes and our hearts, we may find a solution for today. Maybe after 1 year, we may have to look for another solution. But believe me, the meditation of St. Ignatius that draw me my vocation to the society, the experience of Ignatius is when he saw God, the last meditation, acting in the world as the world is. Peace, struggle, young, old, people being born and people dying. This is the world in which he is alive and lives. And we have to just simply try to do something and help him to bring it to a little more human world. Thank you.
Another question, but maybe we can keep our questions short to the point, and we'll take 3 questions before Father would answer.
At one point you mentioned that many times it's a lie that is sold, like in the media. What is happening, do you think, vis-à-vis the family today? And regarding those methodology things that you mentioned, how would you say, how would you react to the media vis-a-vis the attack on the family, vis-a-vis commitment, number of children, that way?
Father Guanes?
Father, you have mentioned three ways to move forward. Prophecy, dialogue, and praxis, more or less. The problem we find in practice is how to balance prophecy and pragmatism, so to say. Can you give us some ideas of how to discern a balance between them? Because as Keynes has said, I think in the long run we all be dead. And secondly, you, if I understood you well, you said that fear is being promoted for political reasons. I'm sure the opinions of Ulrich Beck are not promoted about the risk society we are living in, are not promoted for political reasons. I don't think climate change, which is terrible for all of us, is being promoted for political reasons, the fear of climate change. Hunger is not a question, as you know, which is being spoken about too much. So if you can explain or clarify more, why do you think fear is being promoted for political reasons?
Thank you. One other question. Mr. Ronald Camilleri.
Two issues that are of concern to everybody in Malta is secularism and migration. Migration people coming over to Malta. Can you console us that in your experience in the past, people who tried to deal with these issues, they carried out a constructive dialogue, taking into consideration all issues of those both believers and non-believers, and of course different political parties as well that even use fear to make people think that, look, our culture is going to die out in the next few years almost. Thanks.
The first question touched the issue of media and the fact that there is media today that is attacking certain fundamental values about children, family, etc. Yes, I do believe that. I do believe that that exists. And I do believe that there is, or the response has to be a concern and to develop alternative ways of expressing a message of what we believe. I just want to say, it's very difficult in a short time to say a lot of things. I just want to say that if you feel yourself attacked, and I am aware that you feel bad, and that is happening, but if you organize your response as a counterattack, I am not very sure that we are engaging in a feasible solution to this problem. Second, I was asked to give a balance between the three. I think it's very difficult and it depends on situations, but I would only say that balance, and I have mentioned it before, that balance between these three aspects is possible or becomes easier if we learn to work together. And I do feel, and I have mentioned this in other contexts yesterday in a talk, that we tend to be too individualistic. And I think if we are able to work together, you may have, as a group, you may provide three voices, or you may have three kind of people there with different tonalities, prophetic, which is necessary, but at the same time opening dialogue, and at the same time somebody who really knows what can be changed in the law or how can we go about, I think working together, this is feasible. Fear, if you want to attain climate change by fear, my humble suggestion is that you will achieve very little. Actually, the reaction of people when you put or you talk about climate change and you make the whole discourse apocalyptic is to give you a kick and send you out. Hunger is an issue that needs to be tackled now, but if you tackle the issue of hunger out of some trying to put fear into the souls of people, I am not sure that it may achieve. And therefore, I am saying, I am not in favor of selling fear, even if it is for a good cause. I think what we need is responsible way of presenting a situation. And rather than fear, is calling to responsibility, a calling to solidarity. I am not going to use fear to tell you that what is happening in Africa today, and when it is written 30 years from now, it will be a shame. And in Europe. Secularism and migration. I think this is a hot issue everywhere today. Secularism. And I feel that there are some ways in which it's tackled in a better way than in others. But I'm not sure that we have, I'm talking about secularism. I'll give you an example. While in Europe the term secularism means anti-religious secularism, and we say, whoop, that's very bad, that's creating a lot of havoc among the youth and among many people in Europe. For somebody living in a Muslim country or for somebody living in India at the moment, to speak of secularism is, my gosh, please, take religion out. Too much. What we need is to be able to accept all of us. I heard recently somebody who is living in the Middle East, in Lebanon, and in a conversation, in a dialogue, they talked about secularism. And he said, well, in Lebanon, I would like to take religion a little outside. It is too much inside. What I'm trying to say is that this is a difficult issue. Migration, a very complex issue. We are involved at the moment in very serious dialogue across the Mexican-US border with two or three posts that we have. We have made, collaborated in an extensive campaign during the Bush administration to change certain laws regarding migration. There is some hope that the new administration may look at some practices. And again, you have to go clearly moving step by step with some changes. But we have kept on seriously working. I know at the moment that we are engaged in a very serious situation, or at least 6 months ago, in Ceuta and Melilla. And we have a group of sisters and somebody trying to work there. Horrible, horrible situations of injustice by the Spanish government. And at the same time trying to influence policy. And something has been achieved slowly. So migration is a terrible problem. Migration is a problem in Japan of a very different nature. Let me, in one sentence, there are 500,000 Japanese Catholics, originally Japanese. During the last 15 years, 3 million Filipino workers have entered Japan and they are living in Japan, legally, illegally, nobody knows, sometimes. All of them, majority, are Catholics. And when the bishops' conference gets together and decide what should be the pastoral approach to the church in Japan, a bishop raises his hand and said, my dear brother bishops, what Japan are we talking about? So
your problems, the problems here are huge. Now, how will the Japanese bishops tackle this problem? Well, I think they are on the right direction and they are changing the pastoral approach. But this has to be done with wisdom, with consultation and dialogue, and with being aware that you are touching here very, very rough sensitivities. So, difficult issues both. I am optimist.
We have time for another three questions. Mr. Joe Aquilina, please.
Yes, can you please elucidate a little bit about the role of the laity in evangelization vis-a-vis renewal of the temporal order? We find that sometimes in dialogue with the church authorities, Vatican, you know, if we are a community, which is a prayer community, and then we are doing social work, the link between propagating the gospel, winning people for the faith, and the working for the poor, I feel that the relationship between one and the other, sometimes guidance from the church authorities sometimes confuse us more than help us to understand the link and understand that there is a kind of link between the work of evangelization and also helping the poor. So I'd like you to elucidate a little bit about this subject, about the link between evangelization and renewal of the temporal order or social justice.
It's a question from Jean-Paul, please.
Thanks. I'm always quite touched with examples, with very simple examples, like the one you mentioned of Mr. Dinesh, I think, the Hindu leader who told his people to remember that they are humans before they are Hindu. Because paradoxically, these examples say something which is exceptionally obvious, but which in practice is not so obvious. The paradox in what you said, the lack of identity which many people do feel, is that while many people have problems with their identity, it's very easy to put other people into groups and forget sometimes that beyond the group in which the other person belongs to, that person is primarily a human being. And it's easy to put people into categories and forget that they have their dignity as human beings and that they have their rights as human beings. And drawing on the many points you mentioned, my very direct question is, well, let me put it simply and radically. Can one be a Christian or can one be a believer and not bother with the dignity of each person and with the rights of each person?
Evangelization and working for the poor. Well, I think, obviously, history has been with us. And we have now, 2009, a rather better perspective to look at a number of things that happened during the 60s and 70s, which is it's very interesting. I think what we have become very clear is that there has been also a big change of the situation of the 60s and 70s and now. Let me give you first a conviction. I am working for justice because I believe in Jesus Christ, nothing else. And why that? Because I find it very difficult to work for the poor and for justice. When I have seen a gentleman like Daniel Ortega, who fought and made people fight for a revolution, and at the moment he is the greatest dictator, the most corrupt person. When you talk to campesinos in Central America that have given their lives for a cause, that have been used by people, And when they look at him now, after 30 years, and they ask the question, and I have given my life, and I have fought for this. So, I am fighting, or I am promoting, or I am interested in the dignity of each human being because of Jesus Christ. And I ask you a question, or I leave it to you to think. When you go to the gospel, and when Jesus is talking about the Father and saying something about who God is, and he calls him Abba, he is evangelizing us. He is telling us a word about God. But in the next page of the gospel, he sees a group of people hungry on a hill, and he tells the disciples, please give them some bread to eat. They are tired. Is that not part of his good news, evangelium? And when he is talking to the Syrophoenician woman, a foreigner, a woman, somebody who was not in Israel, and he engages her, he's crossing cultural frontiers. And the disciples, they were already feeling fidgety when he was talking to that woman at the well, and now they begin to see, well. Is not at that moment of time he evangelizing us and telling us that? And he finally changes his opinion and he says, yes, your faith has saved you. So I leave you to that question, the paradox. My simple answer to you is no. I cannot be a Christian and believe in God the Father, Abba, if I don't respect the dignity of each and every person in this world. I cannot be a Christian. And as simple as that. And I would add one little... and especially if that person is suffering, I just cannot. I just cannot close my chip, close shop, and I cannot. But I think that this is our Christian commitment, and I would feel that at the bottom of each religion, we have, you know, tampered them so much to, is that feeling that the compassion of the Buddha was enormous also. And the fact that when a true Hindu or a Bhakta Hindu speaks about loving God in the presence, in the way he lives in human beings, we come to touch here something which is common, but we need to express it from our own faith and point of view. I think that's important.
I think the excitement didn't let me count. I counted two instead of three. So if this is the last question. Dorothy.
Thank you. I don't know, Father, I might just be throwing this sort of without knowing what I'm... what I didn't want to know. With regards to migration, would it be far-fetched to say that perhaps as the West grows older and older, there's a latent fear that the young, much younger African people will eventually take over? Or, in other words, we're going to need these people eventually?
I understand that feeling that you have. But it's a very human feeling. I mean, I'll give you a different example. You've talked about these people taking over. But I'll give you a different example, I mean, in which maybe we can initiate a dialogue. As you grow old, like me, for example, and sometimes I look at my younger brothers and... Well, I am doing a job, and occasionally I feel, my golly, are these people going to take over? Are they going to kick me out of here? And obviously they will kick me out of this job, and thank God for it. But of course, I mean, it's not exactly the same example, and you will say, well, but age is something that happens when other people... Well, I leave you with that. I mean, I think... the moment we begin to talk about human life in terms of power, And if I look at my job in terms of power, and I see a younger person, or I see a colored Jesuit coming here and wanting to take my job, then I am going to feel exactly like you said. But what is life? I don't know.
Thank you very much. I would like to make a comment, Father. If you want to make a comment on my comment, maybe it's not exact. You mentioned prophecy, dialogue, and pragmatism. I try to see the opposites. What are the opposites of prophecy? I would say being dreamless. The opposite of a dialogue is a monologue, and the opposite of pragmatism is being rigid. And I think these three are the fruits of fear. Do we really want to do that? Do we really want to move by fear? And if we examine our consciences, I think we can see that there is this great temptation many times to do that. Whereas Jesus is asking us, not only lay people, even us as clergy, and even we, by the way, are afraid many times, even we, by the way, sometimes are dreamless, and engage in monologues, and engage in rigidity. Even we need to learn from you, lay people. Isn't Jesus telling us to leave everything and follow him, and to go into the world, and to preach the good news, instead of all these cobwebs? I don't know what to think about that, Father.
Thank God I can say no comment.
So thank you very much, Father Fernando Franco. You've come here, you've encouraged us, just like Jesus did when he rose from the dead. And I'm sure that Jesus sent you here. And I hope, I feel that Jesus is calling us all not to be men and women of death, but men and women of life, and life eternal, and not to be afraid to preach this, not by words only, but by the way we live. Let us have a dream of Malta, which is prophetic, which is in dialogue, and which is open and practical. Thank you very much. And have a good night. Have a good night reflecting on what we have heard today. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice in collaboration with the Pastoral Formation Institute, entitled "The Contribution Which Committed Lay Persons Are Called to Give in Public Life." This talk was delivered by Father Fernando Franco.